30 minutes.
All right, thank you. So I want to thank the organizers for inviting me here. It's always fun to come to Santa Barbara. In the summer, the weather's better than it is in Urbana. And actually, come to think of it, the weather's always better here than in Urbana. So it's summer, winter, whatever. So nice to be here. I'm going to tell you a little bit about some work we've been doing in the last couple of years on hybrid superconductor topological insulator devices. These are a bunch of configurations that we've made over the time. Lots of different ways to configure these. Here's my team of people. Most of the work I'm going to talk about today was done by two postdocs, Aaron Fink and Gian Curter, who have both now left my group. Also some students and some previous postdocs who were involved in my group. And if you do the math, I'm out of postdocs, so I'm looking for one. So if there's any experimentalists out there that have good students, I'd be happy to have one. We get samples from Sunchico at Rutgers. These are thin film samples, MBE. And we get samples from Yusan Hor at Missouri Science and Technology. Those are topological insulator crystals. And we also work with pretty much all the theory group at Urbana, and in particular, Puan Gamey, who was a postdoc there, who's now at City College of New York. So the system we're looking at is one that Liang and Charlie Kane made, I think, popular early on and proposed that you could get Majorana states in this system. If you have a Josephson junction, so it's a topological insulator with superconductor contacts, when you have a pi phase shift, the energy levels shift down to zero and you get these Majorana modes. You can calculate the Andreev bound levels in this system, and they have this form. And in particular, at Q equals zero states, you get this crossing where you have the zero energy state. And from that, you can calculate the contribution of the supercurrent from every one of those modes. And they have this very interesting form. And at low energies, when this energy is not zero but fairly low, you find that the current phase relation is distinctly non-sinusoidal. You get these skewed current phase relations. I'll show you some of those later. And in particular, for Q equals zero, you get this sine phi over two dependence, which has a 4 pi periodic current phase relation. And that's one of the signatures we'll be looking for. Now, we like this system a lot. Not everyone does. Most of the people who have looked at Majorana physics have liked to do this in wires because they're you're not very far from theory, and the Majoranas are very stable at the ends of the wires. So this system is not quite as explored, but we like it because, so here's some of the problems. It's a two-dimensional width, so there's multiple channels. You have multiple surfaces. It's a 3D topological insulator, so in principle, currents can flow all over the surface. And you have, as we know, in these topological insulators, they're not fully insulating always. So they're conducting bulk states and a number of different surface states in the topological insulator. But we like this system because it supports the topological excitations without the need for a strong magnetic field. And that makes it really nice to do certain phase-sensitive measurements. You can also access the barrier. So I can come into the middle here and I can do probes such as scanning tunneling techniques and try to understand what's going on in the system. It's also very expandable into the networks, as I'll show you. And you can have many modes of operation to move and control the Majorana fermions. They basically move with the Josephson vortices in the system. So if you can move the vortices, you can move the Majorana fermions. And we can do this by phase, current, or voltage. And there are a number of schemes already proposed how to braid and do logical operations in these. So for example, here's some pictures mostly from Liang's work, the Fu and Kane picture. For example, in a trijunction, if you set the phases in the proper orientation, you can get a Majorana fermion in the center. There's a phase diagram for how that should turn on and off. You can measure that by using squid techniques and set the phases on the junction, and we're working on doing experiments such as that. You can also make networks of these junctions, and you can create pairs of Majoranas or move one from one position to another one. And then going further, there's been proposals for what is a surface code scheme. You can sort of build up a series of hexagons, and the Majoranas sit at the intersections of these junctions, and you can move them around by various phase configurations. And here's just one picture from Liang's paper of how you can do some kind of an operation by forming sets of these Majorana fermions and move them around in the system. Now, what we're mainly interested in is what happens when you apply a magnetic field. So in a magnetic field, the phase is not uniform. It varies across the junction. And what you find then is that the Majorana fermions sit on the Josephson vortices. So they occur, they sit wherever there is a phase shift of pi, 3 pi, minus 3 pi, etc. And so when you apply this, when you apply a magnetic field, you can actually think of these vortices and the Majorana fermions as entering the sample, just like vortices enter a superconductor. So in zero current, when there's current, zero current through the junction, They enter symmetrically from either side, one from each side, and they kind of close up in the middle, so they move together as the magnetic field increases. I should point out, there are really pairs of Majorana's. There's one at the top surface, one usually at the bottom surface. And they move into the sample. If you measure this at the critical current, which is where we do most of our experiments, then there's actually a shift, because the Josephson current applies a phase shift to the junction to get a current. And so these vortices slide back and forth. You can kind of move them back and forth by applying flux to this, or a current to this device. In this case, the junctions enter asymmetrically. One enters from one edge, and then one enters from the other edge. Now, this configuration is also, you can do things where you can control this with a voltage. If you apply a voltage to a Josephson device, the phase winds according to the Josephson relation. And so the Majorana's move through the junction at a speed which is determined by the voltage you apply and the spacing between them. And so just as a calculation, for typical voltages we use, typically in the microvolt regime, and typical sample sizes and magnetic fields, the vortices can move and the Majorana fermions can move at about 1 km/s or something like that. So you can move these around very easily in the sample. So the reason we like this system is, although you trade away a little stability of the Majorana fermions, you get a lot of functionality, the ability to do things with these systems. And here, for example, is some ideas we have for braiding. You can bring in, this is actually a picture from the Yang's paper, but if you have a series of junctions like this, you can imagine moving Majorana fermions, take one around one side, one around the other side at different speeds, and exchange them in that fashion. Okay, so what I'm really going to tell you about today is some transport in these junctions, how far we've gotten with this. I'll show you some Josephson interferometry, where we think we have evidence for this 4-pi periodicity. And then I'll try to show a few experiments that are in progress, mostly not completed yet, things we understand, some we don't understand, about how to do manipulations in this system. Okay, so the materials we use are of two types. We get thin films from Sun Chico at Rutgers. These are MBE-grown films, bismuth selenide on sapphire. These are really nice. The bulk is pretty insulating in these films. In fact, if you measure the conductance as a function of thickness, this is from his papers, you see the conductance is pretty much constant, meaning you're not adding any conductance as you add the number of layers. Only when you get very close to the surface do you see this change as the top and bottom surfaces hybridize. However, there are a lot of other things going on. If you can measure by magnetoresistance and Hall effect, you can look at the surface states, and you can identify two distinct surface channels in this system. One we think is a trivial two-dimensional electron gas that forms on the surface, as often happens on semiconducting surfaces, typically probably 2 to 3 quintuple layers thick in the sample. And these are really just normal states that are there because of band bending at the surface. We also think there's a topological surface state. You can measure a distinctly different state with a higher mobility, and I'll tell you about where that state sits in a moment here. We also do experiments on exfoliated crystals. We find there that the bulk is generally more conducting. Most of ours are, the Fermi level is in the conduction band. The bulk is, but we see the surface states we think are pretty much the same as what happens in the thin film samples. Here's the kind of devices we make. We take the sample, whether it be exfoliated, this is actually a thin film sample. We apply usually niobium contacts. We can put a gate on the top so we can change the carrier density in the system. It's all done with electron beam lithography, and typical dimensions are 100 nanometers by 100 nanometers, or some fraction, or some multiples of that. Here's a top picture of the sample. We can also make exfoliated samples. Here's a piece we exfoliated, put some contacts on it. Here's some little slivers of wires we can actually exfoliate. What we see, and I think this is significant, is we see the same behavior in the thin film samples as we see in the exfoliated samples. That's a nice check. It tells us we're not looking at things specific to one kind of device. And what we learn from that is that we think most of the supercurrent is carried on the top surface of the sample, not around the rest of the bulk. And we think that the bulk conductance does not play a significant role in the supercurrent properties of these junctions. So to start out with a simple experiment, we just put a gold lead and a niobium lead on a piece of a bismuth selenide. And if we measure the conductance of this sample, no supercurrents here, we see this very well-known, it's called reentrant resistance effect. The resistance has some value at zero voltage. As you turn up the voltage, you see a dip, and then it comes back to the same resistance value. This is a well-known effect that's due to a competition between the quasi-particle diffusion in the sample in the inducing of a proximity gap, superconducting gap in the sample. And the fact that this comes back to the same resistance is kind of an indication of very long-range phase coherence on the sample. Now I've turned this picture around, so you can measure now the conductance of the sample as a function of the gate voltage. When we gate the sample, we see these, you can see them here, these sort of checkerboard patterns, which are indicative of Fabry-Perot oscillations in the sample. I can help you out a little bit by showing you these lines here, guide to the eye. If you go close to the gap edge, you see a period doubling of those. You see the period becomes smaller in the sample, or the frequency doubling. And you can see here two distinct kinds of oscillations. Here's one period, here's a second one with twice the frequency. And we understand that by when you're way above the gap edge, you have essentially what are Fabry-Perot oscillations. So we have interference between electrons going across and two other transversals of the barrier. When you have this material become superconducting near the gap edge, you now have Andrei reflection, and you have four transversals of the barrier in the period, and this changes. So these are both well-known phenomena, but this is the first time that we know of that they've been seen simultaneously in the same samples. So this, again, is just an indication that we have very high mobility surface states in these materials. Okay, so I want to mostly focus on the Josephson interference effects here. When we measure these samples, we get a very distinct supercurrent. The gate dependence of the sample is actually very interesting. The resistance doesn't change very much when you gate the sample, but the supercurrent undergoes an abrupt transition at a particular value of the gate voltage. You can actually see it precursors. It starts to look like it's going to fluctuate down as it approaches that transition. The temperature dependence reflects that as well through these oscillations. You see this is the high gate value, the low doping. And then when you go to dope away from so the Dirac point's down here somewhere, because these are the conduction band is in, the Fermi energy is in the conduction band. And so then when you reduce this, you see these two distinct values as if there are two channels of supercurrent in the sample. We have a model for this. I'm not going to spend much time on it. It was a model proposed by Puan Gamey. And his idea is when there's these two-dimensional electron gases, the topological surface state sits underneath that on top of the topological insulator. And when you deplete those states by applying a gate voltage, you turn those essentially into topological insulator, and the surface state pops up to the surface. And we've done a lot of experiments to sort of show that picture seems to be right. And what it tells you is that near the crossover, you get a very complicated behavior where the surface state is meandering up and down the surface and probably across the surface as well. And that's what's responsible for these fluctuations that appear sort of in intermediate dopings. So this is a signature of the topological surface state, and I think an interesting phenomenon, but not really the main focus today. So what I want to focus on is the Josephson interference effects, and this is the simplest picture of that. If you apply a magnetic field to the junction, if you define the phase at one point in the junction, you can determine the phase everywhere else in the junction from the magnetic field. And in a uniform junction, in what's called the small junction limit, no screening currents, you get this typical Fraunhofer diffraction pattern. Now, if you have a more complicated sample where a lot of things are going on, you can calculate the current as well, and it includes a lot of different things. So you can see variations in the critical current, changes in the current phase relation, which will be our focus today. You can see order parameter changes. You can do magnetic field variations from trapped vortices, for example. I realized once that I've only done one experiment my entire life, and it's basically this one. And so everything I've ever done is sort of buried somewhere in one of these different variations of the Josephson interference effect. I realized that when I was giving a talk at the 50th anniversary of the Josephson effect, and trying to praise him, and realized I've only really done this one thing. So anyway, it's a very powerful technique. Okay, so what do we see? So here's the most, I think, interesting data, and we see this consistently in all of our samples. When we measure our diffraction pattern, so we're measuring the critical current as a function of the applied magnetic field, it looks pretty Fraunhofer at first glance, but notice that the first node is always lifted here. The second one is hard. Here's another example, first node lifted, second node is hard. Now, at some point, you'll ask me, what happens to the third, fourth, and fifth nodes? And we don't really know, because the critical currents get small, and we're having a little bit of trouble determining whether that even-on effect persists, but it's, I think, very significant in the samples we see. Here's another interesting feature, is when you gate the sample, So this is applying the gate voltage. That's the drop I showed you before. Here the critical current changes by a factor of 2 at this at zero magnetic field. But notice that the nodes are basically not affected. Here's another example. This time it drops by a factor of 4 or 5, and the nodes are not affected. So whatever's causing the current at this node is distinctly different from what's suppressing, what you're suppressing in the magnetic field dependence. We can also do this with squids. So we make squid devices. Squids are nice because you can control the phase differences. And we want to do that because, remember, the Majorana and fermions like to sit where the phase differences are pi. So by applying a magnetic field to the loop, we can change the phase differences across the junction in a very controllable way. So these are just two junctions, two STIS junctions, and they're in a loop. And so when we measure this, we see the typical Fraunhofer diffraction patterns from a squid, or typical interference patterns from a squid. And so what you see is a typical two-slit interference pattern. There's an envelope, which is determined by the single junction modulation, the single slit interference effects. And then you see these squid oscillations. And notice again that the first node doesn't go to zero, the second node does, and all the nodes of the squid oscillations are actually lifted in this sample. I'll come back to that. It's an important thing to look at. Here's another picture just showing nice color pictures of the oscillations. If we normalize these in the same scale, we see this when we gate this. This is the drop in the critical current that I showed you before. As you gate the sample, critical current drops. But notice the nodes are not changing at all. So whatever's causing the critical currents at these points is not being affected by the interference effects. Okay, so let's talk about this node lifting. And again, I think this is the most significant features that we see in the data. And I should say, we see this very consistently in all of our samples, and so does everyone else pretty much in the field. We've looked at other people's data as well. Okay, so lots of things, it turns out, can cause the lifting of the nodes in the squid. And by that, what I mean are these oscillations, the lifting of the nodes of the small oscillations, not the single junction oscillation. Finite inductance can do that. Asymmetry in the junctions, asymmetry in the loop, and skewness in the current phase relation. I mentioned the skewness effect. The skewness is a leaning over the current phase relation. It's really introducing higher order harmonics into the Josephson current phase relation. It turns out that you can characterize the amount of node lifting, IC minimum over IC maximum, in terms of all these dimensionless parameters. And we can sort of show that all of these are too small except for this squid, this skewness effect. So we can actually model the skewness. Here's what I mean by a skewed current phase relation, this red curve here. That's what you get for the low energy states are skewed forward. And from that skewness, you can actually see that you can get node lifting in the single junctions. Okay, so that's an indication of low energy states, not Majorana states, but low energy Andreev bound states. So what about the single junctions? Now, if you look at the single junction node, the one I pointed out, the first thing people think of is inhomogeneous current distribution, and that can certainly lift the nodes. But we don't think that's what's going on, and give you a long list of reasons why that's true. But the main ones are we see this consistently in all samples, and so it's hard to believe that we would see every sample we made had a right configuration of current inhomogeneities to create this effect. Also this even-on effect, also the node lifting is extremely large in these samples, much more than you would expect from just disorder effects. Okay, so we look at for other reasons for why these nodes might be lifted. I want to point out the very nice paper of Andrew Potter and Liang Fu, who are both here. This is the picture I showed before with the vortices moving in the sample. And their model is that you get hybridization of the Majorana fermion pairs. There's one on the top surface, one on the bottom, when they get to the edge of the sample. This is a very interesting effect. We think it should be there. We don't think it's what's causing our effect for a couple of reasons. One is we can change the geometry of our sample so that these topological insulators persist a long way out. We can change the overlaps, we can change the thickness of the sample, and we don't see the variations you would expect in that model. But most importantly, this model predicts that all the nodes are lifted, not just the first node. It predicts that all the nodes have to be lifted. So the other thing we've thought about is what would happen if you had a sine 5 or 2 component that might arise from these Majorana fermions. So this is, of course, an easy way to think about how it might work. If you had just a uniform sine phi dependence, sine phi over 2 term, it would lift the first node, not the second node. Now, this is obvious to see because to kill off the critical current, you have to cancel both these effects. That only occurs with the even number nodes in the sample. Now, this is not physical because we don't have Majorana's, we don't have a pipe phase shift all the way across the junction. So we worked out this little model here where you basically assume that you only have Majorana's where the phase differences are pi. And so the current phase relation takes this really very complicated form, and notice it is indeed 4 pi periodic, not 2 pi periodic. If you put this into the junction, you calculate the critical current, you see that the first node is left and the second nodes are not, just as we had before. It also suggests that you should be able to look at these Majorana states by some kind of tunneling, and we're working on that now. Imagine taking an STM probe, moving it along here, we should be able to see where the zero energy states are in this system. So this is testable and something we're trying to do. If you apply this to the squids, this model, you see again that all the nodes are lifted in the squid. The first node in the single junction pattern is lifted, the second node is not. And in fact, this is a comparison to the data that we took, and you can see it sort of explains everything we see in the sample. Okay, so the first question is, why can we see this effect? Most people throw this out, and the reason they do that is that there are, first of all, this is a small effect. The sine 5/2 component is very small. So the first thing is, we can see this in part because of this interference effect we use. By going to the node, we've canceled out the sine phi component, which is very large. We've canceled that out in the junction. The only thing remaining, the node should be a hard zero, and it's lifted, and so at that point, all you have is sine phi over 2 current phase relation part. The second thing is, we can see this because it's dynamical measurement. What we actually do is we bias the junction in a finite voltage, and we ride it up and down as we apply the magnetic field. So this is not a DC measurement. The phase is actually winding at something like the Josephson frequency, which is typically in the gigahertz range in our experiments. So, for example, here are here's the current phase relation for the blue curve here would be for the low energy state, the red curve for the high energy state. These are the two parity states. They are both 4 pi periodic, but what typically happens is if you have a lot of parity transitions, if you do a DC measurement of the current, you'll find that you always stay in the low energy state, and that is sine phi 2 dependent, so another sine phi dependent, so it has a 2 pi periodicity. So the reason we can see this is because we actually go very fast, and you can push through this transition and actually measure the 4 pi periodicity. The same thing happens when you measure Shapiro steps. There's been some evidence for Majorana fermions and Shapiro step measurements. I should point out that if you did a static measurement of the current phase relation, you shouldn't see this, and indeed you don't. We've done this experiment. This is a circuit we use, the DC measurement of the phase. There's no phase winding. The phase is always static in the system. And you can see that the current phase relation is indeed sinusoidal. So you don't see this 4 pi periodicity, but you do see the skewness that I mentioned before. Okay, third thing I want to point out is, What we need to do is to measure the parity lifetime. If we want to do experiments with this, do braiding, we have to know how fast we have to go to prevent parity transitions from canceling things out. There turns out you can do that by measuring frequency-dependent current phase relations, and we're working on some experiments like that. The other thing I want to mention is this provides a route for measuring the parity of the Majorana fermions. It's what you need to do in order to braid to do operations. It is the sine of the sine phi over 2 component riding on the phase of the sine phi component that encodes the Majorana fermion pair parity. So all you have to do is to measure the difference between these two critical currents, and you should be able to measure that. So again, there's a lot of work to do that, but that's the route that we're taking in our experiments. Okay, so let me show a little bit about these interference experiments. And again, these are all things kind of in progress. The first one is we're working very hard to measure the simplest thing you can do is look at the proximity effect underneath the superconductor. What's expected is you get this equal pin sparing state where you have a spin up px plus ipy state, spin down px minus ipy state. So for equal spins, this is actually a s plus p state. It's a real state. There's no broken time reversal symmetry. So you induce this s plus p state. If you have some kind of current applied to the sample, and there are certain experiments where you can do this in, you get, because of spin momentum locking on the topological insulator surface, you should be able to select one of these chiral order parameters, so you might be able to get a broken symmetry, an S plus PX plus IPY, or an S plus PX minus IPY state. So to measure this, we want to do the experiment we did a long time ago to measure the symmetry of the D-wave superconductors. It's the corner squid experiment. We put a Josephson junction into two different directions. You can look at the interference between those and determine if there's a sign change. So here's the signature we're looking for. And don't get your hopes up. We haven't got this to work yet. If it's S plus P, you should see a uniform lifting of these nodes, very much like I showed before, the lifting of the first nodes, not the second nodes. If you have a broken symmetry, you now see that there is an asymmetry in the magnetic field dependence of this, so we would be able to pick up that. That's what we've been able to do for things like strontium-ruthenium oxide. Here, in fact, we have made the same. The reason I showed this, thank you. The reason I showed this data is I thought I would have it to show at this meeting, so I'm waiting for my phone to ring and see if the data comes in here. But we have made the samples. You can see corner squids, you can see edge squids on the device. This is the configuration. So what we're actually doing is we're taking this bilayer, which is the topological insulator and the superconductor. It's proximitized, the very thin layers, so there's one order parameter, and basically measuring the composite order parameter of this system. So we should be able to pick out what the order parameter is of this induced proximity region. So next year, I'll come and talk about that. Okay, so here's another experiment we did. There are a lot of versions of this experiment, but if you put a superconducting dot on a topological insulator and somehow confine the states using magnetization so that they flow in a channel, you can make an interferometer. The interferometer, the conductance of this, has an oscillation due to the motion of the vortices around this, the Mariano fermions around this ring. And then there's an extra term here that encodes the number of vortices trapped in this hole. So if I put a vortex in the hole, it should shift this interference pattern and change the phase of the junction. So this is a way to tell if this vortex is carrying a Majorana fermion in the sample. I said there are several versions of this listed here. So here's the sample. It's a junction of the type I've showed you. Here's a superconducting dot. We see the Fabre-Perot oscillations, as I saw before. And in zero magnetic field, there isn't anything else. These are universal conductance fluctuations, no periodicity. There's these Fabre-Perot oscillations. When we apply a magnetic field, we start to see places where we get actually what looks like an Aronoff-Bohm interference effect. And in fact, the period of this corresponds to one flux quantum in the area of the superconductor. So what happens is you apply the magnetic field, the flux is Meissner screened from this sample and goes into the region right around the edge of the sample. We think that field is cutting off the channels and making this a preferential channel for conductance. So it's an interesting experiment because we did not do anything to deliberately confine the field, and yet the experiment tells us it is being confined around the edges of this sample. So we don't fully understand this. We think what's happening is that the proximity effect is being cut off by the magnetic field and forming these channels. At any rate, it gives us a system where we can try this interference effect. So here's the conductance of the sample as a function of the top gate voltage and the magnetic field. You can see here these oscillations are not really well deformed, but they change signs across here and give you a little help here. A couple of channels here where this is the magnetic field oscillations, and these are just the Fabre-Perot oscillations. And what should happen here is that we should see a change in the period of this if we trap a Majorana fermion in the junction. So here's an example of where we may have seen something like this. You see at zero magnetic field, here's the oscillations as a function of gate voltage. And then as you increase the magnetic field, at some point, this shifts and changes by a pi phase shift. That would be the signature of a Majorana fermion entering the sample. Now, at this point, we have no independent evidence that this is really a vortex entry point. And so we put this down into the category of intriguing data that we want to pursue even further. But if this is correct, this could be an indication that these vortices carry Majorana fermions as we expect that they should. Okay, last experiment, and I'll go quickly through this. This is the so-called Aronoff-Kasher effect. So the Aronoff-Kasher effect is essentially the dual of the Aronoff-Bohm effect. Instead of, right, fine, 2 minutes, maybe. Okay. it's been proposed by many people. Here's the way it works. You have a channel such as this. This is just a junction, an extended junction of the types that I've been talking about, so you can get these vortices in it. So if I apply a current, vortices enter the sample, driven by this current. Vortices come in here, they can go around the sample and they can interfere. You should get then a, the Aronoff Cash Effects tells you that this current, this vortex current, should be modulated by a charge that you put in the center of the junction. This is called the Aronoff Cash Effect. If you trap a Meyer on a fermion in this system, you basically back out the phase winding from the Aronoff Cash Effect and you should get no result. So Smith of Ishwishwara brought this experiment to me. He says, so if you don't see anything, you've got Meyer on a fermions. And I thought, this is not a very strong experiment. but if you can do the first part and show the oscillations and show it goes away, that's a significant experiment. This experiment's only really been done once that we know of in a direct measurement. This is done by Hans Moy's group about, 15 years ago or something. No, 20, what is that, 22 years ago. In arrays, and they did this Aronoff Cash Effect. Here's the oscillations that they've seen. This has not been repeated as far as we know. Here's our version of this. This is the sample, this is what I showed in the picture, and we put a gate voltage on it, and we look at the critical current. It has a very complicated modulation pattern, as you might guess, because it's kind of a squid, and it's kind of a junction, and it's got a thing in the middle. There's a lot going on here. If you blow this up, you can see some points here where things change abruptly, right? Like at this point, right at this point. And we think that is evidence for vortex entry. In fact, we're pretty sure of that, because if you measure the conductance, you can see it tracks forward and backwards until you get to this point. Vortex enters, it doesn't come back out. So it's hysteresis in the tunneling current. All right, here's the bad news. We did this experiment. We don't see any Aronoff Cacher effect at all. Now, without trapping any vortices in the sample, we should see this Aronoff Cacher effect. Here's zero magnetic field. You can see there's really no, there's a little bit of noise. This is a very small signal here. No signs of the Aronoff Cacher effect. If we had that, we would be able to look for these steps because we know where the vortices should enter based on those jumps in the current, in the diffraction pattern. So these are all works in progress. And I think the thing I want to really conclude with is that we think this lateral superconductor TIS system is a very attractive one for looking at topological states and Meyer on a fermions. We think we have evidence of the 4-pi periodic periodicity. We think this system is nice because you can nucleate and manipulate the Meyer on a fermions by various techniques. We think we can measure the parity. And I think it makes a nice platform for interference of experiments of the type I talked about. So, thank you.
So, Dale, I had a question about the one which you called intriguing signature, and the so these Majoranas always come in pairs. And so my question is, while one of the Majoranas will be trapped in the center of the vortex, the other mode is running around your device. So shouldn't, if you did a correlated experiment where maybe you saw additional current on the edge and a phase change due to the trapped flux, you know, so you correlate two pieces of information, would that be a good way to tell?
Well, I think you have to check those things. One of the real issues with these pictures, I think, is where is the other Meyer on a fermion? We always know that there's going to be one in these junctions. We, if you have a symmetric junction, if we had superconductors on both edges, we would think that they would be in the top and bottom surfaces. This is the way Andrew and Liang draw it up and hybridize at the edge. Our systems don't look like that. They're a big chunk of TI with the little superconductors on the top. So we think the other one is very delocalized around the system. So we've sort of taken the approach that maybe we can think about, I mean, the single Majorana doesn't really have a parity, but it has a partner somewhere. But if the partner is sort of in some soup of other ones, then we think we can almost think about the parity of the individual one being separate. So I think that needs to be tested, whether or not you can see these effects. That's why we're doing these experiments, right? If you can see these signatures, then this picture of not paying attention, I always ask Taylor Hughes, where's the other one? He says, don't worry about it, it's somewhere. I don't know whether we have to worry about it or not. Certainly if they come in pairs, but I see this like as, again, I think of this junction picture where you have channels and localized Meyer on a fermions as being almost like a series of wires, where the Meyer on a fermion is at the end, and you took all the other ends of the wires and put them together at one place. So this is a picture, and we're not sure how much it holds up, but Right now, when I say I manipulate the Myron of Fermions, we're always manipulating a pair of them. But I think, again, an exchange of the top of the one at the top is equivalent to doing a braiding operation. That's our picture. But you're absolutely right. You want to do all these experiments. Our first goal is to really see, does any of this make sense? Do these vortices move as we predict in this phase model? Do they have evidence for zero bias states? But in the end, no one's going to believe anything until you braid.
Other questions?
Say a little bit more about the methods.
So the technique that we do for the slow method is very slow. It basically never takes a state out of its zero voltage state, and so you just wind the phase. And this measurement can take an hour or something like that. There are ways to do this faster. We've taken this experiment up to about a kilohertz or something. That's probably not fast enough. There are ways to do the way people do in superconducting qubits, do non-dissipative readouts. You can drive the system in a microwave cavity of some type and just measure the microwave conductance of the cavity. And that's a way to measure the critical current without actually at very high frequencies. So essentially you would, instead of putting this in a loop, you put it in an RC resonant cavity and drive that, and then you can induce the current phase relation from that experiment. Now, if you could do that experiment over a wide frequency range, what you should see is a transition from sinusoidal current phase relation to sine plus sine phi over 2. If you could do that, it demonstrates you have a sine phi over 2. It also shows you where the frequency is, which basically tells you the rate of parity transition, which is certainly going to be there. I mean, if you had to guess, I think you'd guess it's in the megahertz to kilohertz or gigahertz range. But that's a guess just based on quasi-particle poisoning.
More questions? I actually have a small question, even though I'm not working in this field. In your data, you would also expect then the third node to be lifted, right?
You would.
And do you see that, or is it too small to be able to see? We're not sure.
Yeah. We have some samples where I would say yes, I think that happens. I think maybe even one of these. I can go back far enough here. Yeah, I didn't show one out far enough here, but we have ones where there's certainly this, in many of these samples, the current comes back from this point. Maybe it's over here. I think here this node I didn't go far enough, but this light we think is clearly lifted just based on the periodicity. When we get out to the fourth one, it's so small. So we're actually doing that right now. We're trying to look at this very carefully. This is an important point. I think it's very significant that that would be the case. But I think, again, the thing that's most significant, this is not a usual modulation.
What you really expect is doubling of the period, right?
You would definitely expect that, right. It's very easy to put in disorder into samples and lift all the nodes. That's very common, happens in lots of samples. It was this, the fact that this is lifted, this is not, is what intrigued us the most about this.
More questions?
Can you elaborate a little bit on the model that you used to explain this? You flashed it before fairly quickly. Didn't quite get it.
Yeah, it's something I cooked up in my sleep, and then Liang and Andrew wrote this nice paper doing it in detail, and I was very happy because I thought I was on track. Where's my model here? So the picture, again, is in this junction. You have a phase that varies across the junction. So the Majorana's are really only stable in the places where the phase shift is pi. So we treat the junction, I'll think of it as a series of wires with different phase shifts across the junction. So at the points in the junction where you have a phase shift of 3 pi minus pi, you expect these Majorana's to be stable. So what we do is the model very simply just says the width here depends on how extended these are. And that's something you would also like to know by doing, say, a STM experiment or something. In those regions, you get a sine phi over 2 term. Everywhere else, it's just sinusoidal. And so most of the junction is carrying current the usual way, sinusoidal thing. And the nice thing is by going to the node of the diffraction pattern, what you're doing is canceling out all the sine phi term. So that goes away. And the only thing left to give you a current is this sine phi over 2 component. Now, one way to think about this is you have a phase-dependent current phase relation, which seems like a funny thing to say, but this is in fact the current phase relation. And it just says that you get an extra amount of current or tunneling wherever you have these pi phase shifts. It's like an extra channel in the junction. But there's only one phase, so you have to maximize the phase for each critical current. So when you're sitting right here, you can actually calculate the component from the sine phi over 2. It's a little bump that occurs right here, and that's the component from the sine phi over 2. So what you're doing in this experiment is really going to this node. That's where the action is, here and here, because everything else is gone and all you're looking at is the sine phi over 2 term. So it's really just a very simple model saying this is a hybrid system with inhomogeneity. So just like if you had domains or something, these are essentially current-carrying domains, and we treat the thing as a single current phase relation. And just by doing that, you reproduce a lot of the features of our SQUID and junction data. So it's not a real high level. I mean, it's really a prediction that these places where there's pi phase shift across the junction act like one-dimensional channels that are carrying current. And if that's true, it's very exciting, I think, because we can make those move. Because you move the flux and you move those channels.
More questions? Felix?
Just coming back to your model on this, the other slide that you just showed.
Which one?
There was the lifting, this one. There was the lifting of the node, but then at the top, there's also this funny feature that it sort of a kink. Do you see that as well?
No, I made my students look for that for about 6 months. But so what that comes from is if you have assigned this phi over 2 term, the junction's going to adjust itself to maximize the critical current. So this point is, in fact, that point where the first Majorana fermion enters the sample. And I said that initially there are no Majorana fermions in the sample. There's no pi phase shift. The whole junction's pi over 2. When you start to apply a phase shift, at some point you get to a pi. That's when the Majorana fermion enters the sample, and it changes the critical current a little bit because it starts to add to that. So this little lifting right there is this extra current. It's kind of the thing that Liang and Andrew were looking at where they hybridize at the end. It goes away at that point. So that should be there. We don't see it. We've looked very carefully. We've done some disordering models, though, and that washes out very easily because you have a lot of sine phi component there. This one doesn't wash out very easily because it's all that's left in the sample. So yeah, we'd like to see that. it shows up all over. You can almost see where they are. That's the first one, there's the second one. These little kinks are where those Majorana fermions enter the sample. If you can make a beautiful junction, I think it would be really telling, but we haven't been able to really see that.
More questions? Okay, if not, let's thank Dale again. And our next speaker is Rosa Valenti from University of Frankfurt, and she's going to tell us about new exotic superconductors.